Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of the Renowned Podcast. Renowned is a podcast for the curious. We dust off the commonplace to look for shiny new relevance as we challenge ourselves to think critically about the objects that surround us, how they echo humanity's past, reflect the present, or foreshadow the future. So, Mark, will you remind everyone of this week's noun?
Absolutely, Allison. Our noun this week is height. Height, H-E-I-G-H-T, of course. I love this one just because, although I came into it, I remember reading it kind of in the middle, but I don't know, I just love this one because it feels so, it's very different, right? It's such a, we came into this thinking common things around us. I mean, technically this is always around us, but it's not sitting in the room with us. I like this one more abstract. How about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I found it because it is more abstract. I did find it a little more difficult for to find a path. But I found
It's that hook, like as we're digging into it anyway, right? It's finding that little crack in the wall, so to speak, that you're like, oh, I can go that way, right?
Right. And because it connects to so many things, it was hard to narrow it down. In more, sometimes we get a word which you can go in many directions, but it's very concrete. This one was just a little hazier, but I really enjoyed it. And I'm really excited for today.
Concrete, like highway. Oh,
I was going to say and dirt, but yeah, highway.
All right. Well, great. Let's, shall we roll?
Let's roll our dice.
I infected you with use of dice for
you did. It's now in my brain. What did you get, Mark?
Sorry. I forgot. Two.
Three.
There you go. Boom.
Okay. So I will jump right into my quick hit.
Yeah. Let me.
After Mark puts 15 seconds on the timer to see if he can keep me pithy.
Right. And go.
Humans have long had an obsession with height and not just our own. Just like we're attracted to shiny objects, we also seem to be attracted to tall things. And today we'll explore that.
Nice. 2 seconds left.
Okay.
Cool. I feel like we're going to see, I'm probably kept mine broad and in a slightly different area than you, but I feel like for the first time we'll have slight overlap in like part of mine, which is
That'll be interesting actually. Yeah. Because so far we've miraculously gone in different directions.
Right. You know, it's true. They seem to, of course, I think echo and like, reverberate off each other, but this one might be slightly closer, but that's cool. That's cool.
Interesting. Okay, Mark, 15 seconds on the clock for you. And
all right. Human height is determined by the amount of bone developed, particularly in the limbs. It is the outcome of complex physiological variables. However, it is also the cause of complex sociological variables as well.
2 seconds left. We are very aligned today on multiple levels. Okay, I'm pretty sure based on that great quick hit that we did not go in the same direction.
Oh, okay.
But I think that you'll be talking about a lot of things that I kind of was finding incredibly interesting. Okay.
Nice. All right. By all means, down your rabbit hole, shall you go?
Okay. Today, instead of going down a rabbit hole, I'm going to be running up that hill.
Oh.
So, I mentioned
okay, 80s songs.
Exactly. That are wildly popular now, thanks to Stranger Things, which I have to say, I love that it's back. Yes. Okay. So humans, as I mentioned, have long had an obsession with height. And it's not just about intraspecies tallness, although that is a thing. And Mark, I feel like you might be going more in this direction and how it ties in sociologically. But I just thought I'd mention in that space, since that is such a powerful kind of draw for humans, tall men statistically reproduce more and they statistically earn more. And that is thought to be due to, excuse me, everyone, I'm getting over a cold, so forgive my voice today and my hems and haws, due to evolutionary biology, since male height probably garnered benefits to survival in the time when all humans were hunter-gatherers. But we don't live in that time anymore. And actually today, current age, shorter people actually statistically have lower blood pressure, they have a lower cancer rate, and they have higher longevity. they are more prone to heart disease. That's the one thing, right, that short people seem to have a negative medical impact, but tall people, actually, it doesn't seem to be such a survival benefit anymore, which I found interesting. I only wanted to throw that in there because it's an interesting little factoid, not what I'm going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about is that besides this seemingly, you know, built-in evolutionary biology preference for height, we also have an obsession as a species with very tall things. Cities and countries compete for the tallest building. People like to stay in penthouses, which come at a higher premium. Great views, horrible risk of surviving a fire. Just throw that out there for you. And of course, the biggest of all, mountains have had a seemingly magical hold on our species for time immemorial. There seems to have been a captivation, you know, when I wanted to explore why it is that we have such a fascination with the tallest natural structures on Earth. And it's a difficult one to answer with hard data, but there are seemingly obvious hypotheses. They're massive, and their heights were once unreachable to us as a species. We couldn't physically reach them. And the human mind tends to think anywhere we can't go, you know, what's up there? What's over there? It's that human drive for discovery and exploration, which also leads, of course, to what seems to be a human drive for new things to conquer. But that's part of it. And then scaling their heights really tests our limits mentally, psychologically, and physically. But perhaps most fundamentally, they bring us awe. And there's a PhD named Paul Piff, and he says, what we're really doing when we go to the mountains without calling it this is searching for awe and a reminder of place in a much bigger world than ourselves. And he is one of the top awe researchers in the country. Did not know that was a thing, but now I do. And in fact, research in the space of awe finds that awe makes us more generous and even appears to reduce stress more than other positive emotional interactions. And there's a quote from Piff that says, awe helps to shift our attention toward the world that we're a part of and the needs of others. It's the antidote of narcissism. And Joseph Campbell captures the importance of awe in one of his writings. He was a literature professor and writer, probably most well known for his book, The Hero's Journey, but he has many, many books. And he explores myth and its relation to the human psyche. And he talks about how, you know, anyone who's had an experience of mystery knows there's a dimension of the universe that's not necessarily always available to our senses. And there's a pertinent saying that he calls out from the Upanishads. These were Sanskrit holy writings, hard to pin down the dates, but they know it was somewhere between 800 and 300 BCE that these writings were created. And they formed the basis of Hinduism. And from the Upanishads, there is something that says, when before the beauty of a sunset or of a mountain, you pause and exclaim, ah, you are participating in divinity. Such a moment of participation involves a realization of the wonder and sheer beauty of existence. People living in the world of nature experience such moments every day. They live in the recognition of something there that is much greater than the human dimension. And I think of that kind of list of things that have drawn our species to mountains for time immemorial, this awe piece seems to be the most realistic to me. And people have had that draw towards mountains, but the modern sport of mountaineering didn't start until about 1865. And there have been amazing feats in mountaineering since then, but I wanted to primarily share the story of one man and what he has done. And I'm quite frankly amazed his story isn't more widely known.
Allison, before you tell his story, I just wanted to jump in with one brief comment. It's kind of comforting for me to hear that this awe is helpful in some ways. As you said, the research shows, and also it may just be my modern sensibility around dopamine spikes and sugar and rushes and like all that comes in one flavor, so to speak. Like we're just chemically trying to find a high, and that high can also not be so good. And in ways it feels like this is giving me a sense of variety of high, that there is an awe versus epinephrine rush versus a dopamine high. And you know what I mean? Gives it a little bit more color and variation, that it isn't just, oh, are we just addicted to riding awe in any sense we can get it, right? It feels more varied and better. I'm dumbing it down to just better, but you know what I mean? More beneficial, that there's a variety than not just like.
Yeah. Go. I love that you said that, because I think if you talk to a lot of mountaineers and you've talked to people, critics of mountaineers, you'll hear, you know, they're in it for the adrenaline rush. Just what you were saying, Mark, some sort of chemical rush we get from putting ourselves in danger. But many of them will tell you their experience is much closer to what Joseph Campbell described and what this researcher described. It is more about this broader connection. I'm sure it's a combination of these things, but it's really apt that you brought that up. So I became obsessed with tales of mountaineering and the men and women who accomplished these amazing feats in 1997 when Into Thin Air came out. It's a book by John Krakauer, which chronicles the tragic climbing season on Everest in 1996, claimed 8 lives. And I am not a mountain climber. I enjoy the outdoors very much, but you're not going to find me engaging in extreme sports. I am not, you know, physically built for it, probably not mentally built for it either. But I've always really enjoyed reading about people who do these things and what kind of human beings can accomplish at their best. And so this book came out and I read it, and I was, you know, my mom will tell you I was obsessed with Everest for quite a while. So I know more than I have any right to about kind of the mountaineering world. But it wasn't until just last year, until 2021, that I heard of a man named Nirmal Persia. And it's his story I want to share with you today. Nirmal, he's known as Nims. He goes by Nims. So that's what I'll be calling him. Nims is a native Nepali. And he embarked on a quest to climb all 14 of the world's tallest peaks in under 7 months. If you know anything about mountaineering, you know that it doesn't sound possible to do. Quick, brief pause before going any further. I do want to share with you what we mean when we say the world's tallest mountains, because there are different ways to measure mountains. There are 3 ways. One is from sea level to summit. The second is from the center of Earth to the summit. And the third is from the base to the summit. And I'll talk just briefly about each of those. So Mount Everest is the tallest from sea level. And from sea level to summit is the standard accepted measure globally. So that is why Mount Everest is called the tallest mountain on Earth. It clocks in at 8,848 meters in height. It was named after George Everest. He was the British Surveyor General of India in the mid-1800s. And he had nothing to do with mapping where it was in the region. He had nothing to do with anything. He had retired, and someone wanted to name the peak after him when the British were renaming everything in the region. The Nepalese name was Sagarmatha, just goddess of the sky. And the Tibetan name, because it straddles those borders, is Chamalongma, which means mother goddess of the universe. So the two of those are very similar.
That was my nickname in college.
I like that you were known as mother goddess of the universe. to Everest's credit, he demurred. He said, I had nothing to do with citing this mountain. There are local names for this mountain. Do not name it after me. And they did it anyway. But I did want to give him a shout out, because I think our examples of, you know, colonists doing good things.
Glad he bucked the trend and was like, I just breezed into town. Please don't name it after me. Yeah, that makes sense.
So that's Everest. If we measure from the center of the Earth, so the Earth is apparently not perfectly spheroid. It actually bulges more at the equators. So if you measure from the center of the Earth, you will find that the highest mountain in the world is in Ecuador, and it's called Mount Chimborazo. And it clocks in its summit from sea level, clocks in at 6,263 meters, so more than 2,000 meters shorter than Everest. But if you measure from the center of the Earth, it's over 2,000 meters taller than Everest.
So here's my hypothesis, and tell me if if you know, you may or may not know this from your research, but my gut tells me, now here's where I'm having trouble. When you first mentioned these three things, I thought, okay, perhaps from the center of the earth to the height is going to give you a sense of the conditions, meaning the thinness of the air or things like that. It's going to be something about the environment and it's going to be challenging, versus from base to top is going to give you more practically and logistically how far you need to travel to conquer the mountains, so to speak. So that feels more like I said, like the logistics of checking it off the list, like you climbed it, versus sea level. But then maybe the air is just as thin from, because sea level's the same everywhere, but maybe.
Okay. No, this is a great question. Give me 1 minute and I will come to it and answer it.
Great.
No, that was fantastic, because when I was reading about the three different measurements earlier this week, I did have moments of, wait a minute, why are you, you know, how
good,
do what,
good.
What, okay. what are the, why are these different? Why did we go with sea level versus the others? Okay. If we measure then that final one, base to summit, Mauna Kea on the Big Island of Hawaii is the tallest. It from base to summit is over, it's 10,210 meters. But if you're standing at the summit, you're still lower than the summit of Everest based on distance from sea level. So just wanted to share all those very confusing measurements. When we're talking about the tallest mountains on Earth, we are talking about the sea level measurement, which is the universal standard. Using that standard, there are 14 peaks in the world, and this is going to answer your question a little bit or shine a little light on it, Mark. There are 14 peaks in the world that are higher than 8,000 meters. All of those are in the Himalayan or the Karakoram ranges, those kind of crossover Nepal, Kashmir, India, Tibet, Pakistan, and China, so all in that region of the world. And above 8,000 meters is what's known as the death zone. So this is why the sea level measurement is important to humans specifically. So if we're the ones who are trying to conquer these heights, once you're above 8,000 meters, there is only 1/3 the amount of oxygen available that, you know, compared to what is available at sea level. So right there, a huge challenge. There are more avalanches. There's extreme cold. And that's why these are the pinnacle of achievement in mountaineering. You wouldn't have such a hard time, even though you are climbing 2,000 meters more from base to summit on Mauna Kea, you would physically be able to handle the summit better. If you made it there, I would not. So let's go back to NIMS. There's limited opportunities for young men in Nepal, right, in terms of careers to go into. So many join the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas are a legendary elite fighting force. They're soldiers. The Nepalese, they have been legendary for a very long time for their fighting prowess. And the Gurkha units are recruited by the Nepali Army, the Indian Army, the British Army, in fact, and a few others. And they're so renowned. They are so elite that former Indian Army Chief of Staff Field Marshal Sam Manekshaw once stated, quote, "If a man says he is not afraid of dying, he is either lying or he is a Gurkha." So these guys are badasses. And I think they admit women now, but I, you know, I should have checked that and I didn't. It used to be a fully male fighting force. I don't know if that's still the case. So after 7 years of service in the Gurkhas, NIMS applied for one of the British Special Forces, and he was the first Gurkha ever accepted into that service, which focused on cold weather warfare. So he's pretty hardcore. So he did this, and then he retired just in 2018 to focus in his 30s to focus on his love of mountaineering. So Nepalese are some of, if not the, I would venture to say the strongest climbers in the world, but they always end up in support roles. They're never for leading expeditions, right? So Western climbers do not climb without Sherpas. Sherpas set the rope, set the lines that climbers need. You know, they go up ahead. They build and strike all the camps. You have multiple camps throughout a climb for mountains, especially the 8,000ers, as they're called. They carry all the gear so the climbers can just focus on climbing. But the wages they earn are a fraction of what clients pay to join expeditions. They get the smallest piece of the pie, and they're the ones who make it possible, and they're the ones who are doing all the work. So NIMS wanted to bring attention to the critical and life-saving work that the Nepalese and Tibetan Sherpas do. And that's how what he named Project Possible was started. So NIMS and he assembled nine Nepali climbers, all of whom he knew, all elite climbers on their own. And with no other support, they set out to summit all 8,000ers in under 7 months, carried all their own gear, did everything themselves on top of climbing. And this is all documented in a film called 14 Peaks, Nothing is Impossible. The film came out in 2019. And as I mentioned, I just came across it last year and couldn't believe I hadn't known more about it. I could not recommend it more. If you don't think you're interested in mountaineering, watch it anyway. It is about much more than that. And it's truly inspiring. So off they go to climb all 14 8,000ers. The first man to ever do that was named Reinhold Messner, and he was an Italian mountaineer. He completed that in 1986, but it took him 16 years. Now, as opposed to the 7 months NIMS and team were going for, he did not use supplementary oxygen, which is mind-blowing. No one is taking anything away from Messner here. Since then, only 43 other people have since completed all peaks. So it's a pretty elite club. None of them have done it in anything. I forget what the next lowest record is, but it's a matter of years, not a matter of months.
Oh, I I still love, though, that what you're describing, because as before you mentioned this, I forget, what is the project called? Project
Possible.
Possible. I was thinking, well, what a strange, quite literally double standard of a standard for the, you know, classically white European background coming in to do this as like a hobby and test themselves. Meanwhile, the native population is able to do this in their sleep, so to speak, like the way that it's happening, right? So I was thinking in my head, like, well, what does that mean? How do we establish something that is combined? And then boom, that's what this is, right? It's, well, let's raise the standard to something that is like a universal, just for humankind achievement, do it in less time, do it carrying your own gear, blah, blah, blah. That's exciting and very cool.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And I think, so Sherpas are, they are physiologically adapted to the mountains. You'll see this in some Andean cultures as well. And I won't go into all the details on the physiology in the interest of time, but they are, you know, physically better able than, say, white Europeans to handle heights. But NIMS and others would tell you
probably as much oxygen, I would think.
Well, it's interesting. It's not that the cells produce more red blood cells, which was originally a theory. It's that the body releases more nitric acid, maybe, in response to the lowered oxygen, which fuels the muscles and allows them better energy conservation. Oh, wow. There's still studies going on it. That's only one of the adaptations, but it's pretty interesting. But as you said, Sherpas are generally much better suited and much better climbers. But Mark, you said, you know, it's a walk in the park for them. They wouldn't call it a walk in the park. It is still extremely difficult for them.
Right. Well, I mean, what they're...
but relatively, yes.
Right. With the project, what they're set out to do. Right. Yeah. I mean, it just, it feels like the difference, though, in like difficulty is
pretty... Yeah, no.
I'm glad you corrected me, though. That makes a lot of sense. I should be like,
They couldn't traipse up and down a mountain in a day and then, you know, be like, yeah, right. I'm fine. So, okay. So Project Possible, off it goes to mixed commentary in the mountaineering world. A lot of people hadn't heard of NIMS, and a lot of people said, well, you know, what is he trying to do? He's never going to do this. This is stupid. Whereas a lot of other very elite climbers really rallied behind him, which was inspiring. And I don't want to spoil the story, but this has been in the news since 2019. So I'm just going to tell y'all, NIMS did it. He and his team climbed all 14 peaks in 6 months and 6 days, which is impossible.
Which is failure. No, I'm just kidding.
to wrap your brain around, right? He wanted to do it under 7 months and he just did it.
Oh, it was under seven. I thought I was only joking because I thought six. So I was like, 6 days over. Oh, so still like substantially, I can't talk, substantially under his 7 month limit. Yeah. That's great.
Along the way, he also broke six other mountaineering world records. So yeah, he, just, you know, just because he could. He also, and again, please, I beg of you to watch this movie. You can get it on Netflix and we will link it in the show notes and on the website. In, I believe it was the first two peaks he tackled. He also led two rescue attempts of other unrelated climbers that happened during his own bid. So he was, I believe Annapurna was the first one they did. And on his way down, he has summited. He needs to get down, move on to the next peak. And there was a climber who was stranded near the summit alone, unrelated, who would die. He was above the death zone. He was out of oxygen. And Nims and his team had already gotten down to their top camp. And then they would have, in the morning, continued their way all the way down to base camp. And they got a radio call from base camp that there was a climber in distress and they had to make a decision, because going back up puts their lives in extreme danger. Anytime you are in the death zone, you are in extreme danger. The idea is get in, get out as fast as you can. And they had already summited. It also, of course, put his project and his timeline at risk and, you know, his decision. And this is all filmed. You can see it in the movie.
This is potentially a really stupid question, but I was a... maybe very, very stupid question. I was assuming that this was done to test themselves, but if somebody got into really serious issue, why can't somebody fly up there and get them?
Oh, because it's a great question, Mark. It's because the air is too thin to support helicopter blades.
Oh.
So the physics don't support. So they can only go so high on the mountain. So what they did eventually, I wasn't going to tell the story, but it's so good. I'm now going to, don't worry though. I'm near the end. So I won't take too much time with this.
I just feel like someone's bound to develop a copter that has, is engineered to handle low oxygen.
They haven't, they haven't yet.
Balloons, I think
it's, speed it's something about the mass of the air, but what they could do, the copters could get as high as, Nim's highest base camp. So if they could get up back near the summit and get him down, which also getting yourself down, even as an elite climber,
something
love that. Maybe Mark, like, maybe this is what you will invent next.
Wait, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, you're not. I'm fascinated by your brain trying to solve this problem. So they had to physically climb back up, which again, they had just completed this incredibly exhausting feat. They went and they did it and he was still alive, which no one could believe. They had to then get him physically, get themselves and him down in a he couldn't walk to their top camp before the helicopter arrived to take him away. It was an unbelievable act and they did it. And there's actual footage of the helicopter getting to the camp, dropping a line. You just hook into the line. They pull you off.
Oh, nice. In the documentary, in the film.
Sweet. And they don't even haul you up to the helicopter. It's too dangerous. They're at the edge of their performance ability. So they hook you to a line and they fly away. And you just watch these guys flying away on this dangling from a helicopter over the Himalayas. So my point there, though, was like, so Nims is doing this. He's breaking other records. And he also at least twice stopped to lead rescue efforts for other climbers on the mountain. So he's a pretty all around good dude. So as I mentioned, some of the mountaineering committee community really rallied behind him. Some were more skeptical. He did get a lot of criticism for using oxygen. So he didn't do it oxygenless. But a lot of people kind of said, are you kidding me? Like, first of all, he's doing that for safety reasons for his own and his crew. He's doing this in 7 months. So his body won't have time to recover. For him to use oxygen, he's carrying all his own gear. For him to be using oxygen is not a ding on the record at all. In fact, Reinhold Messner, who was the first guy to do all 14 peaks that I mentioned, he is still alive. He's written a lot of great books. And he himself, he's interviewed in the movie, and he's basically like, what the F? Of course he used oxygen. Like, back off, people. Like, to try to take this away from him by saying that is absolutely insane. And if you're saying that, you know nothing. So the achievement itself is nothing short of astounding and awe-inspiring, to bring it back to awe. And Anatoly Bukhriev, he's since passed. He died mountaineering. He was a stupendous Soviet Kazakh climber. He once wrote, "Mountains are not stadiums where I satisfy my ambition to achieve. They are the cathedrals where I practice my religion." And I thought that tied these things in nicely from we started talking about awe, which is why a lot of people are attracted to and climb mountains. We look at Nims and what he did, which was about breaking this record, but it was also about supporting his people and showing the world, right, how much more those people deserve, and trying to prove a point that anything is possible if you put your mind to it, trying to create a sense of awe in everyone in the world. And Boukreev really summed that up nicely. And the men and women who, all of them who pursue these heights, they're reaching for more than a physical goal. It's mental and it's spiritual, which is where NIMS kind of fits in. So this obsession with height really indeed does seem to be multifaceted. So that is it for me. I hope this has inspired you to climb your own mountains, be they physical or metaphorical heights, and to seek out awe and wonder every day.
Yay. I love that. It's yeah, exactly. Like you said, it's so inspiring. And you got me thinking there at the end, right? We think just in terms of the achievement of having done it, and it's like an endurance thing or a body endurance, but it feels like it's got to be, it's logistics. It's like the endeavoring to problem solve on a human scale. It's like a constantly, right, striving for more. I love that. Thank you so much for, yeah, I would never have, I think, been exposed to or experienced a story like that. So again, having us, right, do this big experiment of random nouns leading to rabbit holes like this, where I can hear a story like that I just, you know, would never have considered reading about or you know, learning about is terrific. Thank you.
That's good. Cool. I'm so glad you enjoyed it, but I can't wait to learn more about all of the physiological and sociological. It sounded like those might be the directions you're going in, but we'll
yeah,
see.
So I definitely took it in two pieces, because when I thought about this, because as you mentioned, it being so a concept more abstract for us, or where was the way in? So I kind of wanted to think about the physiological and biological take, like what determines height, like what is happening that would have variations in height. And then a little bit of the sociological, like, well, how has height, you know, played into how we're perceived or some of the social dynamics that happen. And I didn't go deeply into either, to be honest. I kind of wanted to take a little bit of a survey through both to expose myself to the science behind the biochem reactions. And then a little bit of like, where is some activity in the research of perception and cool. such of this. So, first, like to always start with a little bit of trivia. Anybody who's listened to past shows know. So question number one of three, I'll scatter them across my rabbit hole here. So Allison, and of course, audience, try to, you know, answer along here, see how you do. According to the WHO, what percentage of the world's children were stunted as of 2017?
Oh, so no multiple choice. I just have to guess here, huh?
Oh yeah, I figured I'd just give you a...
No, that's good. That's fair. You've given me training wheels for weeks now. Okay. 21.
I mean, 22. So you.
Okay, I swear, people, that was not rigged. Close.
That's amazing. Yeah. 22%. Excellent. That's really well done. And so a little bit of backstory on this, although that sounds still fairly appalling, and I think it is twice as good as it was. So that is measured, as I mentioned, in 2017. In 1990, that was 40% of the global average of children were stunted, right? So issues with nutrition, healthcare, et cetera, that would be stunting growth. So that is, of course, a significant improvement in the average. A caveat here, something to keep an eye on, right, is that is still a global average, and there are very significant variations, as you would imagine, from region to region. So it's not to say that even though 22 is still a problem in some areas, it's significantly worse.
Do you happen to know?
Don't have the difference, but I think in the notes, I will certainly have everyone listening and watching some of the work cited and some references where you can look up this information, and a lot of other interactive sort of graphs and ways to cut the data that the WHO has. It's a pretty fascinating thing. I think something that I learned as I dug into this research was that height is used as this marker. It's like a trait that we use for things like this to sort of peg to health and nutrition and, you know, that, from a global WHO sort of perspective on data and important health data. But then also you'll see in the research, height is used as sort of a model for genetic research in many ways. So we'll talk about that in a second. Okay. So yeah, diving into that actually, into the physiological sort of approach. First, it's estimated that 80% of height is determined by genetics. If you were to think of the two factors, either being genetic or looking at other biological factors or environmental factors. So 80% genetic. The other 20% is a mix of biology and environmental factors. So the biological factors would be things like hormones. And when hormones may kick in and be very active in the body, for example, puberty and growth spurts and things like that. And those mechanics, the process of that is really not well understood. So still being researched, people diving into that. I will say in general, all of this is still being heavily researched. It's not like science feels like they have height down pat and we know exactly what's going on at all times, which I think is fascinating. And right, anyone who is into science, as Allison and I both are, know that, right? You learn how much you don't know. The more you know, how much you start to identify all the gaps, right? Gaps you weren't even aware of in the past. So that is exciting that it's still so. Something as universal as height, right, as a concept is still being very, very researched. Okay, so that's biological. The other part of the 20% is certainly environmental, relevant to the question I just asked about children and being stunted. So one, the mother's nutritional status during pregnancy, also if she smoked or any exposure to hazardous substances will be all factors. And then of course, once there is birth and the child is developing, the child's own health with regard to overall activity levels, nutrition, accessible healthcare and quality of healthcare, and also fewer infectious diseases being exposed and dealing with those will generally all come together to, on average, be correlated with taller adults. And this has been demonstrated in studies as well of immigrant families, interesting, who have gone from one more, you know, developing part of the world to a first world and having, you know, wildly different access to quality healthcare, nutrition, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And these studies would show that the children would be much taller. So if you're talking, right, heredity, genetics, you're immediately showing that it can't all be genetics if you're having the same family and exactly the same bloodline have such differences in height. Okay, but let's go back and dive a little bit deeper into that 80%, that genetic. And I gravitate towards this. So audience, you know, by all means, if you're not one to talk about receptors and proteins, I feel like I often go down this rabbit hole, especially when we talked about taste and the tongue and things like that. But I always find this sort of a fascinating way to kind of understand at the most basic level, what's happening? And therefore, why does that excite scientific researchers and what, you know, advances in healthcare and under overall understanding of the science do these things unlock over time? So height is affected by a variety of different inherited genetic variables. It's like it's very complex. It's not like it's just one thing. So therefore, the term that science uses is polygenic inheritance, right? If you were to just breeze through that, I think in a magazine, you wouldn't really think through to break it down, but that's what it means. Polygenic, many genes all coming together for you to inherit something. So therefore, it is very difficult to accurately predict the height of offspring from parents because there's so many different things involved, but they're working on it. And there's, we'll talk in a moment about some large studies that are pulling together hundreds of thousands of people to try to understand genetic markers that do contribute in this sort of matrix effect of polygenic inheritance. However, there are some very specific genetic mutations that researchers have sort of honed in on because they have such a rare but significant impact on height. So here's where we're talking about things like, for example, achondroplasia. And I'll break that down in a second, but achondroplasia accounts for 90% of dwarfism in humans. So if you were to see someone who has dwarfism, it's a very good chance, right? 90% chance that you're talking about achondroplasia. And what this condition is it impairs the growth of bone in the limbs, and it causes some abnormal bone growth in the spine and the skull, but largely the torso is normally developed, which I think I did not get into too deeper into this to say for sure. But, you know, when I was reading about this, I think you think, well, gosh, how is that? How, not to sound too blunt, but how are they alive? How can the organs in that space have maintained to such a degree that they wouldn't have been so sickly that they might not have lived through development stages? I think that's largely why, as the torso is large, is kind of normally sized. So you're not talking about the organs not having the space to function normally. There is, unfortunately, though, about a 20 to 50% occurrence of neurological impairment for children that are born with this, which, you know, moving beyond the torso, you're talking about spine and skull abnormalities. I think that's where that comes in, unfortunately. So about one in 40,000 babies are born with this condition. And those who are born with it, 4 out of 5 instances are actually caused by spontaneous mutation. It's not by inheriting it from the parents. That does happen, but that's only 1 in 5. So 4 out of 5 being spontaneous. I mean, I think we all get it as humans. There's a lot of things that can happen. And if you're expecting parents out there and you're freaking out testing and wanting to know if the child's okay, I mean, I get it, right? There's a lot of things out there that are just possible. And I'm a worrier by nature. So I understand that, you know, we are in an age where we can know so much more about it, like things like this perhaps being an issue. So delving a little bit more into this, and why I'm focusing on this is, again, the research focuses on these things that are more rare to understand the model and to therefore better understand these wider combinations of things that are quote unquote normal polygenic, right, factors. They're going to start with the things that are sort of most observable and have the most obvious data, if that makes sense. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I feel like that's been a common thing in science for a long time. It's like, what jumps out as the most extreme cases? And when you dissect that, so to speak, and understand the mechanics of it, how can you then learn what the dynamics are that are in play so that you can go back to quote unquote standard things and start right to understand them better? So let's see. The gene here for achondroplasia is something called FGFR3. Break that down. FGFR stands for fibroblast growth factor receptor 3 gene. And so what this gene does, it is responsible for creating the instructions to create a protein, right? That's largely genes in general, more or less. This gene is responsible for creating a protein that is a growth factor receptor. And it's specific to what's called a fibroblast. So, of course, me knowing nothing about what a fibroblast was, I was like, well, how am I going to understand what's going on here? How do I position this in context to other things? So a fibroblast is a type of cell that contributes to the formation of our connective tissue. And it's involved in things like healing our wounds, the formation of collagen, et cetera. So at first I was like, well, what does that do with a child being born and the development of their bones at such an early, either embryonic or young child age? Well, it seems that these fibroblasts are teachable very early on. And so a fibroblast can become what's called an osteoblast. Anyone who's a word geek like me and Allison, osteo being, of course, osteopaths are chiropractors in the UK. We call them chiropractors, but bones, right? So osteoblasts would form bones, or chondroblasts, which is cartilage. So therefore, this FGFR3 gene is very instrumental early on with fibroblasts being informed to build cartilage or bone, et cetera.
Just curious, Mark, do they build anything besides those? I know that's where we're focusing for growth, Can they be taught to do all sorts of building tasks?
That I don't know in terms of the fibroblast itself, but this FGFR3 gene, that's a perfect question, because I thought, well, what's the 3 mean? Is it indicative of a chemical structure? Is it what is it molecular structure? And it turns out that three is literally the third of what turns out to be four known FGFRs. Oh, okay. So there is an FGFR receptor 1, 2, 3, and 4. So 3 seems to be very specific to achondroplasia and the formation of cartilage and the bones. So yes, I think what we see is that in general, if you take the three off, this group of receptors, these four, are proteins that serve in general to focus on sort of cell division, regulation of cell growth in general, the maturation of cells, the formation of blood vessels, healing of wounds. And so to your point, it isn't just the bones, it's sort of all of these growth things.
That's right. You so had mentioned critical. Healing. Okay.
Yeah, so no worries. Yeah, exactly. So research into height is seen as this model for how research in other traits that are polygenic can be approached, right? So there are other genetic things that are just as complex where you can't just pin it down to one thing. There's probably a lot of different variations and variables at play. And so height and the research into height is being looked at and followed by others in other therapeutic areas, if you will, to say, well, how are they approaching this very complex thing that can therefore inform their research plans and their research modeling? So it becomes even more important, not just for what they're discovering, but how they're going about it and how they're discovering it. A quick note on some interesting how is something called the GIANT study. I love how these researchers usually find some way, right, to abbreviate the terms on something that is very relevant to what they're studying. So GIANT, all capitals. I do not have written out here what that all stands for, but we'll post a link to the GIANT study. So in 2014, they read out a part of the GIANT study, and this is a massive research involving 300 institutions.
Was that an unintentional pun?
What?
GIANT study, massive research.
Yes.
Continue, please.
with 300 institutions and over 250,000 subjects. So that's a massive amount of subjects. And it more than doubled the scientific understanding of genetic influence on height. So previously, there were about 200 regions of genes that science understood or associated with height. But because of the study, they now have 424 regions that are associated with that. And just to put that into further context, if folks kind of think, well, that's great, but what does that really mean? Anytime we can and do that and find regions, it helps us find what we call mechanisms of action or delivery or things that we can target in genetic treatments. There are now entire genetic drug classes. And yeah, that can, you know, slowly over time unlock, well, sometimes revolutionary and sometimes very quickly unknown, but you know, usually the progress is slow to unlock and new treatments and advances in medicine and the science. So doubling that from 200 to 424 is huge. And perhaps in many more ways, more importantly, it didn't only expand upon genetic areas that were previously suspected or known. You know, it wasn't like they kind of knew in general on the gene where to look. It surprised them in some ways. So areas that previously were not associated at all with skeletal growth, they now are surprised to say, I don't have the full name for it, but it's a particular gene called lowercase m, uppercase T-O-R, mTOR. And that was previously associated only with cellular growth. However, through this GIANT study, they realized, it is actually very relevant to skeletal growth and is in fact associated with height. So this unlocks, again, better understandings, and you never want to just disregard something because this could be a key to unlocking a treatment for rare disease. And anyone out there that's listening, you would well know that when something in rare disease, it can be very difficult for science to find the money and the logistics to research that. So any light shining in the dark towards something that can help unlock treatments for rare disease is really important. Okay. Trivia two, Allison, and audience, of course. According to the WHO, again, about how many centimeters taller are young adults born in 1990 versus those young adults that were born a century earlier? So about how many centimeters taller are young adults now versus a century ago?
I can't believe you're making me do metric. I'm just kidding. I did the same thing with mountains because the rest of the world intelligently uses
you're gonna
the
laugh.
Metric
in my answer context, I did actually give feet.
Put inches. It with it. That's yeah. funny. I'm going to guess 5 centimeters.
Pretty close. So 8 or 9.
Oh.
So 8 or 9 centimeters or about 5% taller now than their ancestors about 100 years ago. A little bit more context. We see that the global mean height for men increased from 162 up to a current 171 centimeters. Now that is going from 5'4" 100 years ago to an average of 5'7" now globally. And we also see that for women, this increased from 151 centimeters a century ago to about 159 centimeters. So that's going from 4'11" on average 100 years ago to a global current average of 5'3". Little factoid. All right. So my quick part two is a little shorter, but it's a sociological take. And I ran across a study that gave me some insight on how the perceptions of relationship to height and earnings have changed. So previously, several studies have reported a direct correlation between height and increased earnings. And this has been data consistent through German studies done all the way back in the 1800s through to several US and UK studies conducted even in the last 30 years. However, in 2014...
Oh, it's changed. Sorry, I got excited. So there's new data. Well, so I think you're going to tell us. Sorry.
Yeah. No. This is... It's not all super uplifting, but it is a little different, the take on it. So, however, a recent study in 2014 that looked at a large and robust data set of 450,000 Swedish males... Now, granted, it is male specific here... with very reliable follow-up data. So why this became possible, I believe at the time period that this data was gathered, there was required military service. So a lot of this data sort of was captured through this process. And then very reliably, their incomes were recorded. So from a researcher perspective, it's much richer data and more reliable data than just like taking surveys or going out and asking people over time. Like this was pretty locked in. In this case, I think when you hear, these German studies from way back when, and these studies in the last 30 years, I think we immediately jump to, at least I do in my head, hiring managers that are A, favoring candidates because they're like impressively tall. So, and therefore, and we can get into why that is, are they somehow sexually attractive? Are they somehow like meaning that they are like on a species level, we feel like they are going to survive more? Like there's all, why is that happening? I think we jump to that. Or we think two interviewers and hiring managers are penalizing or discriminating against shorter individuals. It's either one or the other. You're either doing more for the tall because they're tall or the folks that come in that are shorter, you're penalizing somehow. However, this current study is saying that those dynamics are not gone. I think they're just adding a bit more nuance to what's happening in the data and our understanding of it. So when they dig into it, they're saying you need to look at both what they're calling non-cognitive and cognitive factors in order to make a more complete picture. It can't just be about height, end of story. Because when they dig into it, what they found is that the height plays a role in cognitive development earlier on in their experience. And so what they found is that when you are taller earlier, you are, you know, think of the classic scene in a movie or whatnot, you're picked first in gym class. You are engaged into group activities that will give you a more refined, you could say, or a more tested skill set socially that therefore starts to accumulate in opportunities, in ways to better manage how people are perceiving you, et cetera, and put you on a path, they say through the data, that therefore that can be a quite a substantial thing. It's not just the, they're not just seeing the tallness, they're seeing actually probably better background of experiences. They're seeing somebody who's carrying themselves probably better or differently. So there's that factor as well. So without controlling for these skills, and we just look, okay, what's top line? The study does say, just broadly, yes, in terms of height for these Swedish males, right? It's at 450,000 or so. You see that for every additional 4 inches of height, it's associated with a 6% increase in average earnings. And if you were to do some translation, if you will, from the Swedish economic and cultural environment to say a US and UK, the researchers think it would be about a 10% difference. Why that is because things are a little bit more standardized. There isn't quite the fluctuation in salary possibilities within Sweden. So the thinking would be about 10% given our differences. However, again, this is where I'm saying, let's take that 6% and sort of whittle it down, because that's where you're not controlling for anything other than just height, this like non-cognitive thing. But if you're looking at both, that's where they start to come down. So think about everything we just mentioned, right? Where they're more involved. Also, they found that taller individuals are more likely to come from advantaged family backgrounds. And that is related to what I mentioned above, where if you're not going to be stunted, if your mother's healthcare was better, if your healthcare was better, you weren't exposed to as many infectious diseases, the nutrition and your quality of food that you had available to you is better. So again, it's this other factor, the height is coming about from a whole environment of things that are leading to advantages. Mm-hmm. So after controlling for all of these things, just to sum up here a little bit, they whittled that down from 6% premium, if you will, like this advantage, really down to 1.5% that they think is just due to height. And even if they're looking at that, they sort of end this study and what my research with, maybe even that 1.5 isn't really so much about being taller. It might be about penalization of shortness. So that it almost is explaining all of it away to say height isn't a factor at all. It's all of these other things in terms of cognitive development, of background and environment of the family, and then others being put down, so to speak, because of their shortness.
Although I would argue that if you're penalizing shortness, you are de facto prioritizing tallness.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We don't need to go there.
Yeah, no, it's true. And that's where, to be very honest, right? I didn't spend, you know, months or years with this study. So I feel like you can't explain all of it away. I think there's definitely something there that is saying height and our relationship to it and why it's impressive to us in some way is still a factor. I don't think they would ever explain all of it away, but I do like that the study at least seems to say, hey, you know, and it's written like any study where they're expecting more research to be done. They're not saying everything's overturned, but they're just saying this is more nuanced than these previous studies perhaps provided. So, okay. So ending with trivia question 3, excuse me. On average, oh, this is pretty, so just a yes or no. On average, are men taller than women everywhere on Earth?
On average, I mean, so mostly, like in general?
Yes. Yeah, like on average, are men taller everywhere on Earth? Okay.
Yes.
I thought that might, I thought that might trip somebody up. I don't know, audience, how you did. But yes, on I thought maybe there's a pocket somewhere. But no, yes, on average, they are taller, but the average disparity, the how much it differs, does vary. So men and women are on average closest in height in Gambia, where the difference is only 1 3/4 inches on average. The difference is greatest in North Macedonia, where the difference is 7 1/4 inches.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that's yeah, that's where I left off before my.
That was great. Thank you, Mark. That was so interesting. And so we did not go down the same path at all as you possibly might have. So once again, we got to learn about different things, which I love. I am very fascinated by this idea of I mean, you guys who are watching see us sitting down. Mark and I are both above average height. So I'm 5'9". So for a woman, I'm like crazy above height. And Mark, I don't know what you are.
6 foot.
Yeah. So both of us are above. And, you know, growing up, I really hated that because, you know, girls weren't supposed to be that tall. As an adult, I don't mind it at all. But it is really fascinating to me what that brings and doesn't bring to people versus what the advantages shortness brings and doesn't bring to people throughout their lives.
Oh, I completely left out. And how did I get through that? How did I do that? So this advantage, right? I talked about that those taller may be asked to engage in things that would therefore develop their social skills, leadership skills, et cetera. So there is therefore in this research paper, the call for if this observed dynamic continues to be there, they think it makes a very strong case for actively balancing that in elementary school and other developmental time periods. Because if you see that the shorter kids, if that's happening, you do something to force in the system a more equitable exposure to those types of opportunities so that that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. We're going to flip back now. So I'll jump in with my one big question, which is going back to the mountaineering world. So with humans having this desire to scale the heights, right? Achievement physically and metaphorically, mountaineering is more popular than ever. So it used to be only that very elite mountaineers who dedicated their life to climbing could summit Everest, for instance. There are many other peaks that are just as challenging, if not more. But now, and this was one of the main points of Into Thin Air, which was John Krakauer's book I mentioned in 1997 about the tragic climbing season in 1996 on Everest. One of the problems is anybody with enough money can pay an expedition company to take them up the mountain because they hire Sherpas to carry everything. I mean, that means they still have to train for at least a year and be physically fit. But otherwise, if they have enough money, they don't have to carry their own gear. They don't have to strike their own camp. They can have a personal guide with them at all times who's teaching them how to do everything, who's there to save their life should they get into danger. And so a lot of factors combined in the spring climbing season in 1996 on Everest to cause the tragedies that occurred. Part of that was weather. Rogue weather is not uncommon on mountains. Weather can change at the drop of a hat, making it very dangerous. You can't predict it. But you also had so many people on the mountain that I've seen pictures of this going up certain parts of the climb route. It was a traffic jam of people. So you weren't getting to the summit in the amount of time that you would have expected because you were quite literally waiting to pass through certain areas. And if you don't get up and down in a certain amount of time, your chances of dying are a lot higher than the amount of time you spend in the death zone. So there have been a lot of conversations about what my big question is. Should we now, no matter how many humans want to like have these big achievements of scaling the heights, should we really be limiting climbing on major mountains, both to protect life of amateurs, although you could argue, hey, free will, this is their choice. If they want to pay to potentially die, they can do that. But also because of the number of people, the amount of damage to the mountains is becoming more extreme. You look at pictures of base camp at Everest and higher up the mountain, there is trash everywhere. Because when you're climbing at those heights and you discard a oxygen bottle and you're not an expert climber, you're just throwing it on the ground. Carrying an ounce more of weight is a problem. And those are just left there because for anyone to bring them down, it's incredibly difficult. So all of this trash has been building up on the mountains. So the big question in that community is, do we need to be limiting this for environmental reasons, for safety reasons, for all of these things, even though humans seem to have this urge to do it? And if we did limit it, is the other problem that I talked about the Sherpas and they're not making nearly as much money as they should, but they are making money to feed their families. They are making more money than some of their countrymen because they're able to do this. They then take a hit economically. So how do we prioritize this, you know, achievement goal of scaling the heights that humans have with the income goals and social justice goals that we have of making everyone equal and paying equal pay and making sure we're providing opportunities with then the third piece, the environment. As usual, I don't know that there's an answer, but I'd love to hear your thoughts, Mark.
Yeah. At risk of being the type of person who comes off like, this is the way, like I'm going to wave my magic wand. I feel like this is a classic example of how do you balance the individual versus community, the individual who wants to do this versus what's impacting others when somebody makes that choice. And here's where I would say that I think a lot of us in modern day turn our noses up at regulation because it feels stifling. It feels like it's, you know, quite literally regulating away fun and free will and everything else. But regulation, if done right, will allow for freedom, but in a way that is not endangering people beyond the individual making the choice. So I would vote for, you said the word limiting, Allison. I think it's letting anybody who wants to do it, to your point, do it. And if it's dangerous, they are signing. Right now, I don't know that there's a
which they do.
Everest or Gordon organization. I don't know if there's like quote unquote a national park that is managing this. I feel like there should be, first of all, somebody has to enforce the regulation. But if, say, anyone can get the license to do it, pay to do this, you're free to do it. However, you need to sign away that no one else is responsible. You're not going to turn around and sue the mountain because you became, I don't know, almost died from frostbite or died. And then your family sues the mountain. Like you're doing this for free will. And if you die. Also that you've taken obvious precautions to protect any of the Sherpas or folks that you've hired to help you, right? That you're not I can't think of the word right now. It's, just an irresponsible employer, basically, right? Like that you're not doing anything to consciously endanger someone that you've hired to work for you, right? So that they're not being mistreated.
Yeah.
Because they're
desperate. I think the rub there is, so the first part in terms of waivers, people generally sign up with expedition companies and they do sign a waiver there basically saying, I know I can die. I won't hold this company liable. The mountain spans multiple countries, so I don't think it's mountain specific. Also, Mount Everest would just laugh at your sorry ass. But the point you made about, okay, you know, I need to say I won't endanger anyone else. If you are a novice climber who's relying in, for example, in Into Thin Air, there's one woman who is she was a New York socialite. She's paid her way onto this. She had to be dragged like up the mountain at one point. She might think, well, hey, I can afford this and it's my choice. Like you said, I can make decisions for myself, but she is absolutely de facto now endangering other lives because the Korean professional climbers behind her have to wait two hours for her to get through it. And their risk of death has now increased because somebody who doesn't have the expertise thinks that she can buy her way onto it.
I meant to say the other part of it is it needs to be scheduled. And so say there was a multinational organization that becomes a quote unquote national, an international park or something like that. And the park organization allows people to climb it, but then also when they can. And I know that that's going to open up a huge can of worms
of
when is the time of year that is the premium time that's safer to do it versus others. But to your point, it feels like that's going to be the only way to say it can't be just open season because yes, people will not respect the dangers that they're causing to others. So you'll have to have space and time between the parties. So it's not a traffic jam to your point. That feels like the only way to go. Cause otherwise, and then of course to have rules of, even though to your point, it's incredibly difficult to worry about a water bottle. I think they're going to have to enforce that. Well, you're going to have to, it's going to be part of the challenge is the logistics of doing all of this the right way. I mean, we do that now. You get fined and do things right if you don't close a camp properly, and et cetera, right. et cetera. I mean, we do that here. I know that's not necessarily everywhere in the world. Anyway, that's okay. That's where my head goes, which I know sounds super like idealistic, but
if anyone wants to read more about those thoughts, do pick up. I know I've said it multiple times. I'll say it again. Pick up Into Thin Air. Krakauer is an incredible storyteller. And again, even if you're not super jazzed about mountaineering, I think the drama that plays out on the mountain and the different people and all the factors that came together for this tragedy are really interesting. He's also very controversial. He's been criticized by other climbers for how he portrayed it. So you can read about some of that. He'll even call it out in his book. So he's not the last word on this, but he is one. But they do talk about some of this. And there was a lot of commentary that came out after the book due to the circumstances. But Mark, I imagine your big question is going to be in a very different direction.
Yeah. So I had trouble coming up with one, but it has to do with that last point I made around, do you institute changes in elementary schools and younger schools to balance that dynamic and sort of fight against this natural tendency for the taller to be engaged in things that therefore helps them develop certain skills that later become more correlated with higher earnings, right? So that you don't have those quote unquote falling behind because they're shorter and they're not engaged as much, and that affects them later. Part of me immediately feels like, yes, do that because it's balancing and it's important to have an equitable exposure. But then I don't know. I think that's where I net out that is important because you're in a structured school environment that is intended to put the best tools and experiences into the kids' hands. But where I get a little tripped up is, we're attributing just the earnings metric to a whole large swath of behavioral experiences that could be leading those quote unquote, I hate to generalize this much, but I mean, that's what the research is doing, right? The shorter kids might be developing other skills that in the grand fabric of society are necessary. Like they're learning to do other things and they're learning other skill sets that are not attributed to what you could call jock social skills that become attributable to those that are hiring or have been hiring classically in time. You see where I'm going? It's like, do you really want to start to broadly tinker with that,
right,
or not? And this is a very provocative thing to call it.
It is.
What I'm about to say is like a term that people are going to be, it's a hot button issue, but doesn't that feel a little affirmative action-ish in terms of stepping in to artificially help somebody that we think is being, but I also want to draw differences because I don't disagree with affirmative action, that type of thing is important in that case because you have such demonstrated disparities of broad swaths of metrics. So that's where I'm calling it that as being it's similar in a thread, but I'm also being very clear that it can be very, very different in its impact and its background because I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, but something about it feels tricky. That's all I want to say in terms of do you or don't you
tinker, yeah. Socially engineer. Yes. I love that you kind of walked yourself back there a little bit because where I was going to go to your question when I heard it just now was, I said, when I heard it just now, as if I was trying to pretend like I'd heard it before. And I swear to God, this is the first time I've heard it. I don't know why it came out like that. Was that I do think it's very important for educators and, adults in general, parents, to be aware of all the potential factors that can limit children. But so sure, should we be educating our educators about the fact that shorter children may be being overlooked in certain ways? I think there are more important things to focus on. White children are getting way more privilege than Black and brown children in our schools right now. And I think that the disparity that causes in future earnings for to name just one thing is much faster. Girls are overlooked consistently in science and math classes. That has been changing more with the focus on STEM. Right. People have been much more aware of that, but I think we need to look at the way we're treating people based on the color of their skin and based on their gender. And sure, throw in their awareness of height differences can cause this. But I think focusing only on that, like you said, number one, I don't think the disparity has been proven to be big enough to merit it. And I think it's part of a broader ecosystem of all these other things. So on the privilege scale, I think there are things that are much more worrisome. So, okay, I think we should revisit our ratings from last week before we generate our new noun. So Mark, were we both at a five?
We were both at five, dead center. Yep.
Okay. So I am going to actually raise mine up. I think I'm going to go to a 7.5. And I'm just doing that because I love Nimza's story so much. And I love the metaphorical thinking about, you know, heights metaphorically through mountains and how they signify awe and our linking us with our something bigger than us, linking us potentially with divinity and linking us with achievement, and then what Nims and team achieved and the fascination I have in the mountaineering world. So 7.5 for me.
Nice. And I'm going to go to 8.
Nice.
I'm also going
I almost did that. Now I wish I had. No.
Yeah. For the same reasons. I think when I came into this, I wasn't really sure if I was going to be that interested in what I found. I love that I was able through the research to find both the, you know, quote unquote, higher science, like biological pinnings of what causes it, but then also start to see the social impact and things that we want to consider and keep an eye on. It's like, it's a richer topic than I expected it to be. So yeah.
Excellent. Well, are you ready to give us our new noun?
Yes, let's do it. All right. I'm all set up here. So this will be fast. 3, 2, 1. Slab.
I mean,
slab.
Wow. Huh. Okay.
That's pretty wide open.
That really is. And I have no ideas here. You know, I have no initial ideas, which sometimes I do, but just because I love the word slab, like it's very like evocative of a lot of things. I'm going to go high. I'm going to be risky. I'm going to go with a 7.5.
Okay. I am going to come in at 3.
Wow. Okay. This is going to be fascinating.
Only because, yeah, my gut reaction to this is it feels like I'm treading over past research with construction in my head. So I'm going to have to challenge myself to find a very different hook into the research. You know what I mean? But and that may happen. I may find that and love it. So we'll see what happens.
Yep. It should be fun. Okay, you ready to read us out, Mark?
Yes, of course. So everyone, thank you very, very much for tuning in to our episode 10. We want to thank any listeners that have, you know, both new and old listeners, so to speak. But if you've been with us since the beginning, we love this milestone of 10 episodes now. It's a nice thing for Allison and I to celebrate for the still fledgling podcast. We, of course, welcome your feedback and interaction on social media. Please find us at Renowned Podcast on Instagram. We are no longer on Twitter. That was a conscious effort to abandon Twitter for many reasons that are probably obvious to many of you. We do have our website, renownedpodcast.com. Please check that out. You can find a little bit more information, context, some works cited that we do not, references, right, that we don't post necessarily in the show notes. So please check us out there. And we thank you very, very much for tuning in. Check us out in a couple weeks' time when you will hear us talk about slab. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.